Danny Masterson is guilty and remanded to custody. Those Alec Murdoch graphic videos, apparently released by the court by mistake. That Family Feud contestant, also guilty. And that bizarre Wisconsin case is getting a little closer to trial. Just some legal issues to resolve. Wait till you hear what the argument is being made. A Chicago dad was robbed in his front yard. And could you stand by your child if they killed your other child? And then finally, our dumb criminal of the day. Let's talk about it. Good day, everyone. My name is Scott Reich, and this is Crime Talk. Thanks for joining us. You know the drill. Subscribe if you haven't. Like if you do. Leave me a comment and hit that little bell for notifications of when we go live or put up new content. And always remember, you can listen to us on any of your favorite podcasting apps. First, let's support the people that support Crime Talk.
As a pet owner, you want to give your furry friend the very best. That's why Baked in Colorado's CBD-infused dog treats are the perfect choice. These delicious treats not only taste great, but they also provide a wide range of health benefits for your pet. CBD has been shown to have many positive effects on dogs, including reducing anxiety, alleviating pain and inflammation, and improving overall wellness. Baked in Colorado's treats are infused with premium, full-spectrum CBD oil, meaning your pet will benefit from the whole plant extract. Not only that, but Baked in Colorado's treats are made with all-natural human-grade ingredients, so you can feel good about what you're giving your pet. They're also free from wheat, corn, and soy, making them a great option for dogs with food sensitivities. Baked in Colorado's CBD-infused dog treats are the perfect way to support your pet's health and well-being. With various flavors, including peanut butter, pumpkin, and bacon, your dog will love them too. So why wait? Head to www.bakedincolorado.com today and order your dog a bag of these delicious and nutritious treats. Your pet will thank you for it.
All right, let's go ahead and open the record for June 1st, 2023, and let's begin with our first case on the docket. That's right, Danny Masterson, that guy from that 70s show. Well, guess what? He has been found guilty of having raped two women in a case that got a little bit of attention, obviously because of who he is, and also because of the accusations that were made that the Church of Scientology had tried to discourage his accusers to come forward. Now, the jury deadlocked on a charge that Masterson had raped a third woman, and as you may recall, a first trial also resulted in a mistrial. The retrial lasted more than a month, and the jury deliberated for more than a week. Now, Mr. Masterson was found guilty of the two counts of rape by force or fear, and then Mr. Masterson was immediately remanded into custody after the verdict. That is very normal, because once you've been convicted, circumstances have changed, and you become a flight risk. Additionally, most states have a provision, usually in their constitution, if not by statute, that says if you are convicted of various crimes, your bond shall be revoked, which means there's no discretion. Well, Mr. Masterson now faces a sentencing range of 30 years to life in prison. Sentencing is also set for August 4th. Prosecutors allege that Masterson raped these three women at his home in the Hollywood Hills back between 2001 and 2003. He was charged not until 2020, and obviously he pled not guilty, which is why he went to trial. Two of the accusers made allegations that the Church of Scientology, to which they and Masterson all belonged, had discouraged them from reporting the rape to law enforcement. Now, the allegation that the Church of Scientology denied quite vehemently. Now, what changed from the first trial to the second trial? Well, it's a retrial. The prosecution gets to fix what they didn't do so well the first trial, which ultimately resulted in a mistrial, a hung jury. Well, in this trial particularly, the judge allowed the prosecutors to say that the women were in fact drugged. In the first trial, the prosecutors were only allowed to suggest the possibility that they had been drugged because the women felt disoriented and confused after their encounters with Mr. Masterson. Now, Mr. Masterson's lawyer, a guy by the name of Philip Cohen, has argued that the women's stories were inconsistent and that there was no physical evidence of drugging and no evidence of force or violence. And according to a trial brief filed by the Los Angeles County District Attorney's Office, Back in September, Christina B. had reported the rape to the church's ethics officer, or master at arms, who told her, "You can't rape someone that you're in a relationship with, and don't say that word again." Now, according to the brief, Mr. Masterson raped a third woman identified only as Jen B. back in April of 2003 after he gave her a red vodka drink. About 20 to 30 minutes later, she felt very disoriented. Now, according to this brief, Mr. Masterson raped her after she regained consciousness on his bed. She reached for his hair to try and pull him off and tried to push a pillow into his face, the brief stated. When Masterson heard a man yelling in the house, he pulled a gun from his nightstand and told her not to move or say anything. Now, Jen B., after seeking the church's permission to report the rape, received a written response from the church's international chief justice that cited a 1965 policy letter regarding suppressive acts. To her, the response signaled that if she were to report a fellow Scientologist to the police, quote, "I would be declared a suppressive person and I would be out of my family and friends and everything I have," end quote. Still, the document states that she reported the rape to law enforcement back in 2004. The brief further states that N. Trout told her mother and best friend about the rape but did not report it to the church. Quote, "If you have a legal situation with another member of the church, you may not handle it externally from the church, and it's very explicit," she said, according to the brief. She added that she felt sufficiently intimidated by the repercussions, end quote. In a statement after the verdict, the church said there is not a scintilla of evidence supporting the scandalous allegation that the church harassed the accusers. The statement accused prosecutors of centering the case on Masterson's religion and promoting fabrication about the church to introduce prejudice and inflame bigotry. The church has no policy prohibiting or discouraging anyone from reporting criminal conduct to anyone, and scientists, Scientologists, or not to law enforcement. Now, quite the opposite. Church policy explicitly demands Scientologists abide by the laws of the land. So this has lots of interesting issues. We probably should have talked about this case further. Obviously, the first trial, hung jury. Second trial, conviction. Usually what happens. I can tell you, I've never had a hung jury, and it's been a retrial on the second time, even a third time once, where things got better. It just simply doesn't work that way. The prosecution fixes their case. Now, here you have a situation where something happened, according to the jury, 20 years ago. It puts a defendant in a very tough position. What if there's other witnesses? They're not available. You find this oftentimes in cold cases. You just can't find the people that were maybe potential witnesses or could assist not only the prosecution, but the defense. And if anyone's ever said, oh, you can't convict on he said, she said, guess what? It happens all the time. The Masterson case is that situation. An allegation is made. Somebody denies it. They're the only witnesses in the room. He said, she said, that's it. The jury decides who to believe. Question of fact, done. Even if there's no physical evidence, that's a situation that the prosecution has to deal with, sometimes to the benefit of the defense. In Mr. Masterson's case, it didn't quite work out that way. Anyway, next on the docket, yes, some explicit Murdoch photos. Yep, they were released, kind of by mistake. So Judge Newman, who presided over the Alec Murdoch trial, ordered that the video evidence from the Alec Murdoch trial, a double murder, this year cannot be released to the public. Now, a court official explained that an unredacted body cam footage from the Colleton County Sheriff's Office deputies, Daniel Green and Chad McDowell, was not sealed when it was inventoried during Alec Murdoch's trial. The video should have been sealed as they captured glimpses of the crime scene and during the trial, which obviously led to the conviction of Mr. Murdoch and his life sentence. It was revealed that most of Paul's head was removed as a result of the shotgun blast at point-blank range. The videos were given to Netflix. Crew was working on a documentary about the case. And according to reports, the redacted versions of these videos do not fall under Judge Newman's recent order. Boy, wouldn't you like to get a copy of those? Not to be gruesome or anything, but it'd be interesting to see kind of a better view of the whole crime scene. But obviously, we wouldn't do that because there's a court order saying we can't do it. We wouldn't want to do that. All right. Guess who else was found guilty? That Family Feud guy. Remember him? The former contestant on Family Feud has been found guilty of breaking into the home of his estranged wife and then shooting her dead. Mr. Blefnik appeared on ABC's Family Feud back in 2020 and joked with the host, Steve Harvey, that somebody's biggest wedding mistake would likely be getting married at all. He then said, "Oh, honey, I love you," when he was addressing his wife, and before adding cautiously, said, "I do." His response evoked laughter and some gasps from the audience and left a blank stare on Steve Harvey's face. Well, the episode was recorded in the fall of 2019, but aired in the spring of 2022. And Timothy Blefnik did not testify in his own defense after being accused of killing his wife back on February 2nd in Quincy, Illinois. Her father found the mother of three deceased in her home after her family became concerned that she hadn't shown up to pick up her sons from school. Yes, she was unable to do that because she was shot 14 times. And court records show that the couple had separated and were going through a nasty divorce. Now, Blefnik did not present a defense to the claims, simply said not guilty, and he was going to be sentenced on August 11th. Prosecutors alleged and proved to a jury beyond a reasonable doubt that he used a crowbar to break into the property through a second-story window before shooting his estranged wife in the bathroom. His wife, Becky, had also sent a chilling message to her sister, Sarah Riley, before she died, warning that if anything had happened to her, the number one person of interest needs to be Tim. I'm putting this in writing that I'm fearful he will somehow harm me, come after me, or will try to do something to me that takes me away from the kids or the kids away from me. The court heard Blefnik's researched ways to commit the crime on Google before riding to her home on a bicycle. Investigators retrieved dozens of shell casings in the basement that the state police lab found was fired from the same gun and ultimately recovered from the crime scene. The couple had three sons together, but were living separately at the time of Becky's death, and court records show that they filed for divorce in February of 2021, and court records also show the couple, who married in 2009, was going through a nasty divorce, as both parties had filed for protection orders against each other. Ladies and gentlemen, yes, I understand it. Sometimes marriages don't work out. That's a shame. Sometimes it gets really nasty, quite contentious, but it's never a reason to go inflict physical harm on anyone, okay? It's a divorce. I get it. It sucks. You're going to have to co-parent, and you're going to have to go make more money. That's just the way it is. And hey, you can always remember, you married the other person. Just remember that. All right, that's a Wisconsin bizarre case. Getting a little more bizarre. Do you remember Taylor Denise Shaw Business? Well, she was in court as her new attorney. And the reason why she has yet another new attorney was, well, she attacked her last one in court. So the new attorney is a guy by the name of Christopher Froelich. And he argued there's no evidence that Shaw Business could have sexually assaulted the victim beyond the statements that she made to law enforcement while on drugs. Now, as you may recall, Shaw Business is charged with murdering and dismembering her lover while on methamphetamines and trazodone. And her attorney argued that a third-degree sexual assault count should be dismissed because the victim was not a person under the law at the time of the alleged offense. Now, the defense argues that the victim was not a person at the time of the alleged incident, as the victim was deceased. Therefore, under the Wisconsin statute, 940.225 shouldn't apply. The defense asserts that once the person is deceased, they're no longer a person as defined in the jury instructions. The defense then questioned how the victim could have even been sexually assaulted if his penis had been removed and he was, well, frankly, unable to consent because he was dead. The state alleges sexual intercourse, yet the alleged victim's appendage was apparently found separate from the decedent's body. The decedent was not able to consent, as specified in the statute, therefore, no crime. Now, the Wisconsin third-degree sexual assault statute states that whoever has sexual intercourse with a person without the consent of the person is guilty of a Class G felony, and whoever has sexual contact in the manner described within the subsection without the consent of the person is guilty of a Class G felony. The defense claimed the prosecutions can't prove sexual intercourse took place under the strictest meanings of the term, and they further claimed that there was no evidence that the defendant intruded into the deceased's genital opening as defined under the jury instruction. The defense asserts that there was an appendage that was detached from a body found on February 23rd when law enforcement came to the home at Stony Brook Lane. The defendant was not at the Stony Brook home when police arrived on February 23rd of 2022 and was at the Eastman Avenue apartment on the date in question. There were apparently other alleged body parts found in Jimmy Choo bags, alleged body parts in an Under Armour bag, and a crockpot box found in a Chrysler minivan, the motion stated. The defendant apparently blacked out as she reported to police, and the defense asserts and argues that it would be unlikely and almost impossible for any sexual assault to have occurred because how the dismembered body was found by law enforcement. The appendage was not attached to the body, and the appendage was unable to function due to its condition. The defense further asserted that testing of a dildo that was allegedly placed into the anus of the victim was inconclusive for DNA evidence. In closing, the defense made their argument as clear as it could be. No sexual assault can be proven due to the penis being disconnected from the body. It's impossible for the state to even be able to show probable cause that the assault occurred due to the fact that the body was allegedly dismembered into many parts. According to the criminal complaint, investigators found the victim's severed head in a bucket in the basement after the victim's mother found the deceased at her Green Bay home. Now, Shaw Business allegedly admitted to investigators that she went crazy during a meth-fused sex and choked the victim to death with the chain that was around his neck. Shabas stated that she then began to choke the victim, and she described it as the victim lying face down on the bed with her on top of him pulling on the end of the chain. The victim coughed up blood, and she was waiting for him to die while she was watching his face. Shaw Business commented that she was already this far, so she just kept going, referring to choking the victim. Now, the criminal complaint also states that Shaw Business said in a lower tone voice, "Yeah, I like it." And the detective believed her to be referring to when she was choking out the victim. Shaw Business also stated to police that she thought it took 3 to 5 minutes for the victim to die. And Detective Kempf clarified with Shaw Business that when the victim began to cough up blood, she just did keep on choking the victim because she wanted to see what happens. Now, Shaw Business made a comment that she blacked out while choking the victim, but when she awoke up, the victim was already purple, according to her statements. Chavez has stated she enjoyed choking him and made comments to the detective asking if they knew what it was like to love something so much that you kill it. Chavez has told police they've had fun trying to find all the organs she scattered around the scene, including the victim's penis. Chavez has stated all of the body parts should be in the basement, and Chavez has stated to the police there would be a foot or a leg in the minivan. Detective Graff asked her during the interview what she did with the head, and she stated she put it in a black bucket and put a blanket over it. Now, the defense said that these statements are going to be subject to a motion to suppress, which will be forthcoming. Now, the prosecutors countered the motion by saying that the statute at issue applies whether a victim is dead or alive at the time of the sexual contact or sexual intercourse. Another motions hearing is set for June 13th, and the trial is set to begin on July 21st of this year. As I noted, Ms. Shaw Business officially lost her previous defense lawyer, Quinn Jolly, back in March when she, well, attacked him in open court, inspiring yet another attorney to leave the case as well. Interesting case. I hope this one is televised so that we can watch it. There's been some competency issues in this particular case, but Ms. Shaw Business is deemed competent to proceed. If the statements are suppressed, if the defense prevails, possibly unlikely, well, you know what happens. Prosecutors would have a tough way of making their case other than trying to link them. But more than likely, her statements are coming in. And it sounds like she may need to spend the rest of her life in prison. You can't just kill people to see what it feels like. Next, a dad robbed in his own front yard. Yes, video captured the moments of a Chicago resident being robbed at gunpoint by a group of masked thugs in front of his home as his wife and kids slept inside. Victor Galena Sr. was on his way to work about 6 a.m. on Friday in Chicago. He was in the Hermosa neighborhood there, and he and two companions were accosted by a group of robbers wearing ski masks. They started pointing a gun at the dad's head, and the victim's son, Victor Galena, told police the group had been counting the money they planned to spend on the construction tools that day when the thugs attacked him. Fearing the men may try to enter his home, the father stayed in the doorway. The video captured the moments the resident was robbed at gunpoint by these masked thugs. Now, Galena Jr. said his unarmed dad was definitely a hero, and he says he doesn't want to feel like a hero. It was just most likely the father instinct kicked in. It's the people that you look up to that you call right away when you need someone to defend you. And if they can't defend you, then you are going to call if you are defenseless by yourself, he added. Now, police said the same group of thieves later committed the same crime against at least 10 other people as part of a string of robberies in which they targeted residents leaving for or arriving from their jobs. Now, the victim was robbed in front of his home, and his wife and kids and another relative slept inside. Now, citizens fearing that the group could enter the home, Galena stayed in the doorway. The group is tied to at least 36 other robberies and carjackings, according to police. The suspects were wearing black ski masks, dark clothes, blue gloves, and they remain at large at this time. The crime occurred a day after the new mayor, Brandon Johnson, unveiled his plan to push for violence prevention and provide millions of dollars to youth outreach groups. Chicago had a long Memorial Day weekend during which 9 people were killed and at least 43 others injured. Nice. And I was there in Chicago this week. I'm lucky I made it out alive. It's strange that it would be safer going to Gary, Indiana, the former murder capital of the world. Chicago, I love you, great city, but man, you guys got to do something up there. Hey, could you stand by one of your kids if they killed one of your other kids? Well, the Oklahoma mother of a 12-year-old girl who stabbed her brother to death in a demonic rage says she was a normal child until she went back on her medications that she had been taking off of for a year, and that caused her to start cutting herself. Now, the girl is being treated in a children's facility in Tulsa. And on January 5th, the young girl stabbed her 9-year-old brother, a kid by the name of Xander, to death in their home in an unexplained attack. Her mother told police she stabbed the child 3 times while he was lying in bed trying to sleep. Afterwards, as she was being placed in the handcuff, the girl sobbed, "I'm so sorry, I don't know what happened." The mom said it was some sort of demonic bleep. The case resurfaced this week with the release of the body cam footage of her arrest and her mother, April's initial conversation with police while her son was in the hospital. He died of injuries a short time later, and in all of the footage released by the Tulsa Police Department, the mother and the daughter both believe the boy is still alive. Friends of the family have set up a fundraiser in the month since the attack to help move with the 3-year-old son. Her 12-year-old daughter remains in a juvenile treatment facility. Now, in an update on the fundraising page, which has so far raised about $10,000, the mother stated how her daughter was a normal teenager who never even yelled at her until she went back on an unspecified medication that she stopped taking for a year. They were good kids. They were raised as God-fearing children and never had behavioral issues until she was put back on a medication she was off of for a year, the mom said in a statement. She did not specify what type of medication the girl was taking, said no, it wasn't psych meds. Now, since killing her brother in January, the girl's been receiving treatment in a center where her mother says she seems to be improving. She's been very well behaved the entire 6 months that she has been gone. The mother said that she is very supportive of her daughter and loves her very much. Obviously, there's a lot of healing that we both need before we can ever live together again. And she needs mental and emotional help after all of this because there's going to be some permanent damage. I would say so. When she was taken into custody, the girl had cuts on her arms, which she told the police were self-inflicted. The girl's mother said this week that she never self-harmed herself until she went back on the medications. I don't even know what to say. I mean, if it was truly something where somebody was not guilty by reason of insanity, some sort of mental breakdown as a combination of these drugs, and given the child's young age, what do you do? Could you be such a good person and stand by one of your children that killed your other one? Could be tough. All right, next on the docket, our dumb criminal of the day. Remember how many times I've said some of the worst disputes ever are neighbor disputes? Let me give you an example. That's right. A 59-year-old woman, I'll say it again, a 59-year-old woman was charged after allegedly attacking her neighbor and then squeezing an officer's genitals before kicking him in the groin repeatedly. Meet Pamela Zlacha. Now, she was charged with aggravated battery of a peace officer, two counts of criminal damage to property, battery causing bodily harm, and resisting a peace officer. Zlacha walked onto her neighbor's property on May 5th. The complaint says that Zlacha kicked down a garden trellis and broke the homeowner's cell phone, causing about $1,000 in damage. The complaint further alleges that Zlacha then struck the woman in the face with a handle of a pitchfork. Good thing it was the handle, not the other end. And the police department responded. Officers attempted to arrest Ms. Zlacha. And the complaint then alleges that Zlacha began resisting arrest by kicking and swinging her arms. Zlacha then grabbed a police officer's testicles and kicked him several times in the groin. While Zlacha was resisting arrest, she grabbed the sergeant by his neck and broke his gold chain, valued at $1,675. Zlacha was not immediately arrested, but ultimately an arrest warrant was issued for her arrest on May 12th, and she was taken into custody and made her initial appearance this past Tuesday. She has since been released after posting 10% of that $50,000 bond. A preliminary hearing is scheduled for June 5th. Ms. Zlacha, what got into you? That trellis in the garden, maybe, perhaps? I don't know. But to keep that rage going for the police officers? Not good at all. Ms. Zlacha, you are our dumb criminal of the day. And I get it. If you have a neighbor dispute, I get it. Things happen. But it ends when the police show up. Bottom line. Thanks for watching. We'll see you next time on Crime Talk.